This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for coming to another staff seminar. We're really privileged today to have a special guest who's flown down from Brisbane to talk to us, Alfred Fletcher, and his mate Kev Swift is here as well. Both of them went to Westbrook Home, and they'll be talking about some of their experiences there, which Adele will facilitate for us. I think you might all know Adele Shanaworth, who's one of the curators on the Inside exhibition, along with Jay Arthur. So I'm going to hand over to Adele now, and then I'll run the question time at the end of, or towards the end of the seminar. And we are recording the session, so we'll pass the mic around at the end. Thank you.
Thanks, Alison. It's wonderful to have Al here today, and I made three promises to Al. One, that I wouldn't make a big song and dance when I introduced him, which is very hard because I think he's worthy of a big song and dance. I also promised him that we wouldn't put him on trial today. Al has been on trial most of his life since childhood, so he's not here to be on trial. And the third promise was that I'll let him out for a smoke at 1:30. So we'll stick to time. And so the reason we're here today is in conjunction with our pending exhibition, Inside Life in Children's Homes and Institutions, which opens on the 16th of November here at the National Museum in Canberra. And that exhibition will look at the three groups, if you like, of children who were in homes and institutions: the 50,000 Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children, many of whom identify with members of the Stolen Generations, and also former child migrants, who are about 7,000, who came to Australia. And, of course, of the 500,000 who were in homes, most were Australian non-Indigenous children. And it's that group that Al is a part of and that we're focusing on today. And also, just another introduction is that, as a way of introduction, is an understanding that, to put it quite simply, is there was a two-tiered system, if you like, in institutions. There were children's homes, but there were also reformatories, detention centres, institutions for those children who were deemed to be uncontrollable. But what's really important to understand is that children could be incarcerated not for committing a crime, but merely for being a status offender, for being a runaway, for example. And, of course, no one asked those children why they were running away or from what circumstances they felt the need to run away from. And so, as I said, we're not going to ask Al why he ended up in Westbrook, because, as I said, he's been on trial and I think he's a bit sick of it. Perhaps the best way to just introduce is in Senator Andrew Murray's own words, when he talks about the children from Westbrook outside of Toowoomba as inmates. I use the word inmates because they were treated as if they were actually the most dangerous or malicious of criminals rather than the vulnerable kids they were. However, having said that, I could not even condone the atrocious and heartless treatment meted out to Brook boys, even being meted out to hardened criminals. Even though some of these boys had committed minor misdemeanours and were regarded as delinquents, most came from disadvantaged families where alcoholism, poverty and neglect were the norm. Like Crow, and that's Al's nickname, and as the Forgotten Australians report reveals, many children found themselves in a court of law where they were ultimately charged with being a neglected child and sentenced to institutional care. In itself a frightening experience, but what lay ahead for many was far more terrifying. And just a few about Westbrook, and then I'll hand you over to Al. Westbrook was a state-run institution, and it emerged from the Proserpine, which was a boat which was moored in the Brisbane River, which was a reformatory for boys in the late 1900s. That was then transferred onto land, the facility at Lytton, and then in 1900 the Westbrook Reformatory for Boys was set up in Westbrook, which is a small area outside Toowoomba, Queensland. In 1919 it was named the Westbrook Farm Home for Boys, and in 1966 it was renamed again Westbrook Youth Detention Centre and closed, finally, at the end of June 1994. So Mr. Fletcher, Zelle Fletcher, born in 1945 in Brisbane, author of the book Brutal, Surviving Westbrook's Boys Home. As he said, he doesn't want to sing and dance, he just wants to say he's alive, he's here, and happy to be at the museum. This you can't get anymore. This is the third edition by New Holland Publishers. It's sold out, but it's soon to be made an e-book through Amazon. So I'd really commend it to you. It's a really fantastic and enlightening read. So do you want to talk about why Westbrook was closed down at the end of 94? How did that happen, Al?
Well, they had more trouble in Westbrook again, and I believe they had another inquiry, and I think they realised it was time to close it down, because they had one inquiry in 1961, in May 1961, and they spent a lot of money having this inquiry, the Swarton inquiry, and apparently they didn't learn by the Swarton inquiry and the Queensland government. If they would have let the inquiry out to the people to read it, not making it a closed inquiry, it might not have progressed on the way it did. If it would have been released as it should have been released by law, but they kept the document from the public.
Mm-hmm. And what year were you sent to Westbrook, Al?
June the 25th, 1960.
Mm-hmm. And what was your involvement in the Swarton inquiry in 61?
Well, I had quite a bit of involvement in the Swarton inquiry. I went there on three occasions. And I told exactly what was going on in there, and I was not very popular over it all. Mm-hmm. And also the food I presented with the grubs of root and the food. And the food was found unfit for human consumption by government analysts and many, many other things about the brutality that was dished out to innocent people.
Thank you. We've got some archival film footage of Westbrook, just 2 minutes. Now, this was shot in 1950. Now, Westbrook became infamous when Roy Gollidge arrived, Superintendent Roy Gollidge, in 1952. And he... What was his nickname? What did they call him?
Oh, I'm not sure.
No?
Many names.
What was...
Was he just Big Jim? I think they used to call him Big Jim.
Big Jim, yeah.
He was about 6 foot six tall and a very big man.
Yeah. So this is before Gollidge. This is Superintendent McMillan. Now, the way the museum treats heritage footage and photographs about institutions is we don't necessarily see it as a reflection of truth and reality. I suppose it would be used akin to what we would call marketing these days. So it really reveals how the media was used to construct a certain image about homes and institutions. So we'll just have a quick look. 1950 Westbrook, a couple of minutes. Tell me what you think of it. What do you want to say about that, Al?
Under McMillan, I do believe he was okay, what I heard, but then it went into another era under the Gollidge and his mob. That may have been the case how they're talking there then, but it was still very bad. But I can assure you, none of that rubbish there was going on when Gollidge and his mob were running the place, and the state government backing the superintendent for all that he wanted to inflict on anybody in this place. So I think that'll answer that the best I can.
Can I interrupt there? I went there in 1956, the building...
Sorry, Kev, can you use your mic? Just because what you're going to say is so important, we just want to get it recorded.
The,
It's on. You don't just have to talk into it. Thanks a lot, Kev.
Yeah, well, I went there in 1956. The buildings were still the same. The gardens were still the same. But, you know, it's all bull. I mean, Al's been a little bit diplomatic, but, you know, it was just rough. And that is just propaganda.
Okay.
That's correct. That is the greatest bit of propaganda I see. And I'm not anti because I was in there. I'm only saying what I experienced and in the place.
Thank you. We've also got a couple of photos. Thanks, Alison. If you just... This is taken from the 1999 Ford inquiry. These photographs were published in the newspaper, but they were reprinted as part of the 1999 Ford inquiry in Queensland, entitled The Abuse of Children in Queensland Institutional Care.
Those photographs were taken in 1957.
Uh-huh. Great. Anything you want to say about those, Al?
Well, it's a different photograph than when I was in there, because they took that round thing around the post there, and they had a post in the middle there, and they used to run them around there till they dropped on the ground. Children. They run them around there till they dropped.
And why would they be forced to run around the pole?
Well, you might have been talking in line, or you might have been smiling or laughing or having a joke. That was frowned upon. You weren't allowed to laugh. Or you had nothing in that whole yard of balls or bats or... you had nothing. You got one toothbrush when you got in there, and if you got no more, you never had another toothbrush. So that's what the place was like.
A lot of the reasons for your punishment could stem from that garden beds that they showed you too, because you could be so hungry that you'd eat your own vegetables.
So you'd be flogged. You'd be flogged if you're caught eating any vegetables from the patches. Now, them patches, I owned a couple of blocks of land there myself. They still owe me about $200 from them few years that I sold all my goods. But I ran away so they lost my money. So I worked the hell out for a couple of years, if you know what I mean. And myself and many, many more never, ever received our pay. And that's proof. That's all what I'm saying is all in proof. It's not from me, it's the proof.
Thanks so much, Alison. If we could have a look at... This is Queensland parliamentarian John Mann, who initiated the Shorten inquiry in 1961. Is there anything you want to say?
Yeah, I would like to say something about that. There was a boy there by the name of... I think he's passed away now. I seen his gollies shove a bottle of castor oil down his throat and break his teeth. A full bottle there. Well, naturally, you got the runs all day and all that. You can imagine it from it. And castor oil treatment was quite a regular occurrence up there. If they were in one of their silly moods, as I'd put it, probably. Luckily, I never got the treatment, but there was one case where one boy was supposed to have suffocated from the castor oil treatment and was taken to the Toowoomba General Hospital, but I think from there they put him in the loony bin. He was a boy for the loony bin job. That was another thing they did. I tried to get myself admitted in there, and unfortunately, well, I'm glad, I suppose, they said I was sane, you know, and that's how the word crow became about, you know, because I ran away and hit up a tree. But many of the boys ended up in Willoughby and the mental hospitals around Queensland at the time. And a boy by the name of an Aboriginal boy, he's come from out the bush, and he was a real, you know what I mean? He wasn't used to the white man's ways or anything like that. He died in there. He was went through the inquiry, not the inquiry, he went through the Boggle Road incident and everything else, but he died in... No, in one of the mental hospitals, and his mate is an Aboriginal boy also. He died very young from it all. I'm only going on a few cases and many, many suicides. I mean, I could mention the names, but...
Thank you, Alan. There's a painting here. Now, this is a painting done by your mate, Robin Parnell, and this is a painting of you. Would you like to tell us what that painting's about?
Well, it was Robin's way of doing the best he could. He couldn't talk on the matter, so he's a good artist, and he done three paintings, and he gave them to me. He said, and this one here and the building is what happened to me after he ran away. See, I was talking to Robin Parnell before he ran away, so I was naturally a part of the scene. I got flogged when he ran away, and I was put on the path, which is, say, approximately the length of this room, and posted one end and a post at the other. They had several of these posts, and you had to march up and down all day long, all your spare time, up and down, up and down. And if you didn't march fast enough, you copped the lash. And that was I was there for 4 months. Because he ran away. How could I go up and say, well, I know this man's going to run away? You know, I was only a boy. I'd only just been in there a few weeks. I'm talking about myself, but there was many, many more that went through this same treatment.
And that's... Right. And that's a photo of you on the path.
Yeah, that's right. I'd like to say that they sent him insane, and truly, I want you people to get the real, true history of this. And what they did to the Aboriginals was nothing more than disgusting. I wouldn't treat a dog like it.
The reason Alf would have finished up on the path is that you were, with Gollidge, it was guilt by association.
There's something you've prepared for us to read. Do you want to read that out?
Oh, I'd like to.
Thank you.
Oh, I'll do the best I can. Excuse me if I get a bit upset here.
It's very courageous of you because we know how hard that is. So thank you.
Today I'm going to try to outline what really happened in this boy zone. The effect of what it did to society and the effect of what is done to the remaining people that are still alive through this. I hope I can do justice for the ones that are not here, for the many that suicided, for the ones that entered into mental asylums from Westbrook boys' homes, for the ones that are in jails caused by Westbrook boys' homes, and for the ones that are mixed up, two people, and for the ones that are missing and maybe never to be found again. Yes, I have been in Westbrook Reformatory for Boys and Boggle Road Jail and Silky Oaks Religious Home and Riverview Salvation Army's Boys Home. Yes, I have attempted suicide and gone through life as if two people in one. The real me is what you are seeing now. The other is still suffering from Westbrook. This wasn't the way to break children in those days. It was accepted in those days, but in my opinion, it wasn't accepted. Not everybody was doing all this to their children. It was only in the 60s, I mean. This kept on going on for many, many years. This was straight at the fault of the Queensland government that allowed this to continue. Shame, Queensland, shame. I witnessed suicides, murderers, bank robbers, rapists, the lot. What caused these boys to do these awful things? The boys I am referring to are the Brook boys. But what went up in there for years and years, you came out there very sick. You see, they flogged, raped, the food unfit for human consumption. Half didn't even own a toothbrush. One set of clothes per week, no underwear or singlets, etc. You worked in them and that's all you had for the whole week and you stuck, you know, that's all you had. You had no lockers for you. Put your clothes in because you had none. You put it at the end of your bed. Laughing was frowned upon. Caught, flogged. After a few years of this and much, much more, as I could not say here today, as it would horrify you people, you then became two people. When escaped or released, you couldn't mix with normal people or hold down jobs. You were an outcast. I was sick, and many, many more were very sick. I should have been treated for insanity, and the rest with me after they made us this way. All of what I have said is proven beyond all doubt. There are some matters I cannot talk about owing to legal matters, especially when I was first sent to Westbrook by Judge Andrews, as this would affect too many people. The Queensland Government are the guilty people here. They sanctioned and allowed all these horrors to happen. The State Children's Department gave the okay to all requests by the superintendent to inflict his insane ideas upon us innocent boys in Westbrook. I mean, we were no... what the hell would I put it? We didn't deserve this treatment. This didn't do anybody any good. It just wrecked them mentally, and they came out and wrecked society with it, if you understand what I mean, and wrecked their wives, and they couldn't settle down into life in general. We were too screwed up in the head. The Queensland came up with this great idea to send 16 boys that run away in the mass break to Bogger Road Prison in Brisbane, all under the age of 16 years. Now, out there is only two alive today, and that rest went long, long time ago. I'm one of them, thank goodness.
Al, can you tell us about the mass break, when that was, what the mass break was, and why was there a mass break?
Well, the mass break was roughly early 61, or not that early, a few months before the inquiry had in it, and it was the biggest mass break at the time in world history. About 60 or 70 boys ran away in one go. And a lot of them, they rounded up and they said they were chasers, so nothing happened to them. But the ones that got away, they thought they got away, they may have stole a car or something to get out of the Toowoomba Range, because there's no cars or buses. You couldn't walk that far. I had one attempt at that, and it was too far, to be honest. Or they might have took food. I took food from the local hospital. I snuck inside and stole some food out of there and some clothes, because all I had on, I think, was a pair of, you know, dungarees or something. And so I was then charged for that crime and put before the courts, and then Carney was his name, put before the courts and then sent to Bogger Road. The others had done misdemeanors, some of them were very small things, but the ones that had done anything at all, they rounded them up and they said they were all the ringleaders, or half the ringleaders were back in Westbrook. So they had to make a show of somebody. So they sent us down to Bogger Road.
Sorry, Alison, we've got a picture here of Bogger Road Jail, and this is what was called the Black Peter. Now, you were put in this in Bogger Road Jail. How old were you when you were put in this?
I was 16.
And what year was... So what's that?
1962.
This is what was called the Black Peter in Bogger Road Jail. Can you explain what this is?
Well, I must admit, I was only in there for a couple of hours, but being a young boy, it's not very nice to be threatened that when you come back in here, you're going to do plenty of time down here under the ground. They put me in there for a couple of hours and locked the door, probably to scare me not to talk no more about what was going on.
Just a concrete wall.
Yeah, it's a, well, I have to explain this. You go down the stairs and it's just a big cell under the ground with nothing, pitch black, and they used to give you a loaf of bread a day and a mat on the ground, and that was your food and a pannikin and water. They'd only leave you in there for up to 7 days.
They must that's all right then.
Yeah. So they had to let you out for 2 days every seven. Very close Aboriginal friend of mine that's in the book that just died recently, he was done 21 days down there. How he ever lived to 72, I'll never know. But he made it. Mm-hmm. And the place was full of ex-Westbrook boys, because 9 out of 10 when they got out of there, they ended in jail. 9 out of 10 people did. They had a fantastic rate. So as for this reform and children, by bashing them and brutalising, forget it. It don't work. It doesn't work. Anyhow, I'm not saying too much.
No, it's very important, Al. Thank you so much.
Well, you got that about the birdcage too.
Yeah, do you want to talk about the birdcage?
Yeah, I'll get that out of the way then. Well, I was put in the birdcage in number 2 division when I was in there for about 3 weeks.
How old were you? Is this 16?
Just turned 16. I was about 16. I must admit, the officers were really dirty against all this. They didn't like what was going on, and neither did the criminals in there, or the crooks, as we'll say. And they all treated me with respect and all that there, but I wasn't allowed to speak to nobody. I had a mat on the ground, I was on half rations, and I was in 2 division, is a very notorious jail in Boggar Road Jail. It was notorious. It was for all the murderers and the lifers and all that situation. I was fed half rations. I was handcuffed in the morning. When everyone else went to the jobs or whatever they'd done, they'd come in, they'd handcuff me, one on each side. That's right, one on each side of an officer. 16. I never went out and fought people or bashed people, and took me down there. But the officers were right, they'd always give me a smoke under the shed so no one could see it. But, you know, they had their job to do. And then they'd put me in the birdcage, and then I'd stay there for an hour or two, and then taken back to the cell, which was all padded up so you couldn't, no one could look in, you know, if you know what I mean. You couldn't look out. You could look out through a few little spy holes. And then when they went, after the dinner break, they'd take the other lot out and they'd come back and do the same thing again. So I was pretty well locked up, about 21 hours a day, all told, for 3 weeks. The superintendent used to get the light coming over. His name was, and I don't mind saying his name. And he used to say to me, "Have you had enough?" And I said, "I shouldn't even be in here." And I said, "I'm quite peaceful with what is going on here." Well, no one was hurt me. It was better than Westbrook. An awful thing to say. Anyhow, that's about that on that, and they eventually let me out. Then he put an Aboriginal boy in it. Well, he came from, you know, out the bush, and, you know, where I could probably take it better than an Aboriginal boy. That always affected him very seriously. Well, anyhow, he's dead now. He died very young. I hope I've helped you out somehow there. Oh, I don't have to read that out because anyhow, I'll read it out from there. My own treatment was the birdcage in the notorious number 2 division on half rations, plus many times in the pound. Well, the pound is a lock-up. You just, you know, you do 7 days in there, half rations, and, you know, you had a Bible to read if you wanted to read it. And once in the Black Peter. And I've got to hear now, what a good kill rate, Queensland. Remember this. The government, what a beautiful rate. The Queensland government are the guilty people here. Now, the worst part about when you got out of Westbrook is that you were very, very mixed up. I called it the lunatic asylum. You weren't cured of anything, but very hurt. Mixed up mentally. All sorts of problems by the Queensland government-run boys home. I was sent to Westbrook 3 times by the judge. That's escaping, and then they just send you back, and so you ended up, if you had no record, had a little record, when you left there, you had a record that big. The last sentence I received was 2 years straight. That's after I'd already done about 2 years. The rest were released or did 6 months in that new security compound built in Westbrook. The reason I received the 2 years, I spoke out on 3 occasions at the Swarton Inquiry about Westbrook, and I was not very popular with anybody in the government and the warders in Westbrook home. In my opinion, it was payback time for me. No one else got the 2 years. Just me. What did I do so different than everyone else? But someone had to be the goose to make it look good. Luckily for me, I escaped from the compound and didn't do the 2 years. And one of the main reasons that triggered me off writing the book Brutal was the injustice I and the rest received, plus the judge originally that sent me through all this Westbrook show, admitting to me, which I have evidence, it should never have been in the Brook at all. But I went through all that before all this came out. Plus the withholding of parcels and letters from my mother, father and sisters. You see, I blame my family for not writing or coming to see me over them years. Some 47 years later, I received my mail under the Freedom of Information Act, and the Queensland government agreed to stop all visits or any communications to me. I have the proof of what I've got to say here. I have it. As children, we were young Australians, not men, not capable of understanding fully what was going on. It's too late. My family are all dead for me to forgive them for something they didn't create. Another reason, the terrible floggings 3 Aboriginal boys received. It horrified me. What I witnessed, it has never left my mind. You see, the Aboriginals received twice as much floggings as the white boys did, and 90% did nothing wrong to end up in this lunatic boys home. Also, I could say with accuracy 80% of boys should never have been in this sadistic place. The book Brutal, which was written, explains as much as is possible and also outlines quite a lot, and the copy of the Swarton Inquiry in the 1960s is worth reading. By the way, that is, finally, they released it, only because it was proven to them that it was illegal holding this inquiry from everybody.
And who pointed that out but our own Dennis French? So Al sent me a copy of the Swarton Inquiry, which was embargoed until 2061. And he can explain, if he wants to, how we got a copy. That's up for him to say.
Well, I suppose I don't care now, because the Commonwealth Police threatened that if ever I go to court and bring out this inquiry that I had, that they would be charged from where I got it from. I did smuggle it out of Parliament House and gave it to many politicians in Australia over the last many, many years.
So Al sent me a copy, and I said to Dennis, from our copyrights and publishing section, look, I'd love to publish on the internet, and I know we've got a snowflake's chance in Hades, but, you know, what do you reckon? So, dear Dennis, because he knows his job so well, you know all that better than I do. You've been here longer, most of the staff here. He found that it had an embargo on it in 2061, but, dear Dennis, that didn't stop him. He then found out, did more digging in Queensland Parliament and found out that it was tabled in Parliament in 1961. And, of course, we know for our democracy that if something's tabled in Parliament, it then becomes public. So it had been illegally suppressed for 50 years. When Queensland Parliament found out that the National Museum knew this, they then, for the first time in 50 years, published it. And so we now do have it on our exhibition website published. You can download the full shortening, is the full shortening
it
inquiry.
It is not. But one day you may read the end of it. There is another part to this, but it's too, I don't think they can ever release it. There's too much badness in this. I don't think it'd be good for the Australian public to find out just what we were running in this place, how governments were running. You know, it's... Anyhow. I'll get on. Anyhow, I would... Now, here we go. Sadistic Place. The book Brutal, which was written, explains as much as possible and also outlines quite a lot of the copy of the Swarton Inquiry in its 1960s. It's worth reading. One boy did 8 years there for letting a horse out of the pound. He said the horse was going to be killed and he loved the animals and he thought, I'll let him out. He done 8 years there. He had no education. We only buried him 2 weeks ago. He had no education or anything. He was unfortunately illiterate. He just worked on the farm. Now, on a brighter side, things have improved since the Bligh government took over. She closed Westbrook down and allowed the Ford Inquiry to investigate. I bet she wished she never did it. Plus a small compensation to the victims. Many things have changed for boys put in institutions in Queensland. Excuse me. So one must not blame the Bligh and Beattie governments for what happened in Queensland homes. I'm not blaming one government, as all governments were involved in this along those many, many years that lunatic asylum was operating. My mother's situation and my sister's and father's situation when they sent me the mail was one of the reasons for writing the book, Brutal. I will answer what questions I can. But anything to do, including myself, what they were sent there for, or any crime they committed, I am not answering. They are not going to be on trial here today, as we have been on trial since we went there and when we got out. When you applied for a job, if they knew you were from Westbrook, you could not get that job. If you went to court for any misdemeanor or small thing, he would always say you were in Westbrook. And then you ran away and charges kept accumulating. So I suppose the judge looked at it and thought, oh, this is a criminal. But these all accumulated while you're in Westbrook, all these things against you. I hope I'm explaining the best I can. If you went to court, he would always say you're a second-rated citizen. So we are not on trial here today. How I survived this whole mess... There's only one way I can answer it all. I pray to a higher power, ask for guidance, and I know I have received it. I am not mad or hold any grudge against anybody involved in Westbrook. And I know that plays a big part in my survival today. A lot, unfortunately, are not in my situation. A quote from me in the book Brutal, what which can be obtained in your library or through New Holland Publishers in Sydney. I must thank Senator Andrew Murray for his forward to the book Brutal, and Karen Walsh from Mica Projects in Brisbane, and all you good people that came here today to listen and learn. And I hope if any of this goes into history, you don't doctor it up to suit our society. As the saddest thing about all this was inflicted to Australian children by Australians themselves. This was not a prisoner of war camp. This was an Australian prisoner of war camp.
Sorry.
Thank you, Mike. I don't know if it's against their children. And my ending is, without forgiveness, there is no growth. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Al. Thank you for...
There's so much I could say and show you people what damage it's done to society. This has done tremendous damage to society. It's cost the society untold money. I mean, they pensioned me off. They tried to put me in a pension when I was about 26. I wouldn't take it. They said, give you a pension. They said, we're cuckoos, you know. Hundreds, they really all ended on pensions. You know, and then they got married and then their wives couldn't understand, you know, why they were the way they were, and they had good wives, and, you know, they could only put up with this for a certain time. And I mean, I still sleep in my own room, in my own bed, on my own. And I have a very wonderful wife, a very good wife. Unfortunately, my first wife, she was in a home for 8 years herself, so the two of us together weren't really a good mixed. But I couldn't show love from it all. I mean, I've got three wonderful children, and none of them ever been in trouble. And I can't really show love.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for your courage and your honesty. And I know that by retelling to a certain extent means reliving, and the courage in wanting the truth to be heard greater than the difficulty in reconnecting with those feelings. You're held in high esteem here, Al, and we are very grateful from what you have taught us today. Are there any questions? And Alison, thank you so much for your help today, Alison. If we could use the microphone so that we can hear the questions, thank you. Are there any questions of Al?
Al, thank you very much. That was really moving, and thank you for coming along today. I guess one or two things that I picked up on, you talked about one of the guards offering you a smoke, and you talked about having a Bible when you're in Boggo Road Jail, and you talked about the horse issue with Kevin Williams. How do you, and right at the end you talked about without forgiveness there's no growth. Did you have that conviction all the way through from a young childhood, or, you know, what was the turning point for you to forgive?
Well, I suppose you had to try to look for something better than nothing when you're in these situations, but you had to have to try to have faith in something. And the older I became, you know, I would say that I do get help from a higher power. I do believe that I pray to something to help me, and I say it with honesty. And naturally, I went through the stages where I believe in nothing and that, but I had to watch myself that I didn't let the sacred eat me up too much. And when I got out of there was a lot of, I can't see it then, but I can see it now. There was a lot of hatred in me, and I was a very hard man. Not proud of it. And all I used to do was just get drunk all my life to forget it. And just go town to town and work wherever I could work in it. And as I got older, I've understood what has been the cause of me being what I was, or what I am, or what I feel. And that is the lucky part about it, but many of the others can't grasp that, that was the cause of our problems. I hope I've answered that somehow.
Hi Al, my name's Barbara. Thank you very much for sharing with us today. I just wanted to ask, in the book that you wrote, Brutal, when it first came out in 2006, what was the response that you got from not only friends and family around you, but from government and other people? What kind of response did you get to that book being published and released?
Well, it did a lot of good for the families that didn't understand their father. And the children, that, you know, they wonder why their father was a bit funny, or, you know, of a normal, what we classify as normal. And I don't think the government liked it first up, but they didn't do anything about it, but they had to accept it. It was relieved. It did a lot of good for the families and the children of these people from Westbrook. That naturally the families couldn't understand their father, you know what I mean? He'd have some strange ways. I mean, there's a lovely letter here, right, that you may have read from a woman to me, and I gave it to you. It's really a letter, it's worthwhile reading, of what she went through in her sisters and all that, she went through from her father. And when he died, she then realised it was what this was all about. And then she knew her father, but he died, you know, and she could forgive her father for some of his insanity, I suppose.
So Al got letters of gratitude from, you know, loved ones of ex-inmates of Westbrook.
And even some from the Royal Brisbane Hospital, the superintendent wrote letters saying if he would have only known this, because he treated a lot of boys from Westbrook, and they used to put you in Ward 16, the rat part. They'd lock you in, you know, put them in there. They're nutters. But they weren't nutters, because if you told the story, what was going on up there, he's a nutter. They didn't want this out. And they all went out of their way to hide what happened. I suppose the reason being that they were too ashamed of what they'd really done. I hope I've answered that somehow.
Now, thank you for telling your story. My name's Phil. I'm just wondering if anyone's been held to account for what's happened to you and so many others.
No, I can answer that for you very good, and then you go on. No one has been held to account for any of this. No one. The only one that's been held to account is the poor victims.
And have you thought about what you would do if you were the government? What could be done?
Well, if I was the government right now, there's not many people left. Not many left. I would at least offer them some proper medical instead of us paying for it all. I mean, I've had broken ribs. I'm still suffering today from a kicking from the superintendent. I still got to go and pay for, you know, I get the pension, but I still got to pay all the extras, you know, the extras $50 from the doctors and all that. Why can't they at least just pay for that? Pay for the extra cost of medical things. Excuse me saying it, but if I got on a rowboat and rowed across here, I'd be getting paid for the extra, if you know what I mean, if I had any injuries causing the rowboat. but apparently we can't pay out the victims of... It's not going to cost them $1 million. It's going to cost a lot of money. But they just refuse to want to do this situation. I hope I've answered that best I can.
Yeah, very well. I'm also, just a comment, I suppose, but I just wonder why we haven't learned and we're still locking people up, people who do get on boats, who've done nothing wrong.
Mm. I wasn't having a go at them, I was sort of putting it in a category.
Yeah, no,
you know? I am an Australian citizen. I've been here a long time, and the rest of me mates, we were brutalised by the Queensland government, and they knew about it, by our own people. Why can't the ones that you're finding out your real history about fix them up? It's no big deal. It's not going to cost, it's not going to bankrupt us.
I couldn't agree more.
Everyone?
Al, my name's David Arnold. I'm just wondering, following on from Phil, how do you feel now, a couple of years later, about Kevin Rudd's apology? And do you feel that that has really carried any real weight? And what do you think the consequences of it have been?
Well, it was very good of him to do that. It's a credit to that to happen. It should have happened a long time ago. Regarding myself, you can apologise all day long. It means nothing to me. I can't feel it. But then there's a lot of people that it did much good for. But as for myself, it means nothing. It's too late and nothing's been done about it. No. I can apologise all day long, but if you don't do something about it, what's the good of apologising? Doesn't bring back those... Well, it was just nice of him to do that and good of him to do it, but I would find that very hard for me to really give an answer on that. I could give the answer on myself, but I cannot talk for the other people, but it would have done a lot of good to a lot of people. I'm probably just got too hard from it all.
I'm just a bit conscious of the time. Margot, can it be a quick question?
This is a quick part of the long question. No. How many kids went through Westbrook overall? You said the breakout, there were 60 or 70, you know, over the years it was open, which was a few decades.
Oh, it would have been thousands and thousands and thousands, you know. There was 160 boys in there, 139 boys in there when the mass breakout. Well, once they got into it a bit, they let them all, about 60, 70 go then, but it was... Went on for all those years, don't forget, from the 90s, you know, from, well, we'll just talk from, say, the 50s on to right through, but it was always full of boys. So you're talking about thousands and thousands and thousands of children.
And there were other homes around too that were doing the same.
Mm. Well, yes, they were too. I was in them too. But they're nothing equal the lunatic asylum.
Adele, is it all right with you if we wrap it up
now? Yeah, it's smoke o'clock, I think.
Can I just say something?
Yeah.
Somebody asked before if the book done any good. Well, I can tell you for a fact that it did, as I'm one of the boys that it helped. I'm an old boy now. But my family is in a very extended family. I have 11 brothers and 4 sisters, and many, many nephews and nieces, and they didn't understand their father, uncle, or anything. They do now. They've read the book. They understand. And I have received phone calls from many blokes who have read Al's book, and they all said the same. My family does now understand me. And I've had that from people that live in Malaya, England, it's all over. So Al's book has done a lot of good.
And so has Al's talk today. Could you please join me in thanking Mr. Alfred Fletcher and Mr. Kevin Swift.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.